Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Thursday, May 16th. This is host Richard Benulli. We have returning guest Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, Will You Be Richer or Poorer? And most recently, Global Crisis Now Renewal, Revolutionary Grand Strategy for the United States. And his blog of twominds.com and now Substack is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites, the blog of twominds.com. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. Always a pleasure to tackle another big topic.
Yeah, great. And what do you have in mind today? I know you've mentioned some of the writings by Michael Every of Rabobank Singapore.
Yes, correct. And it kind of ties in also with another economist who you've had on the program, Michael Pettis, based in China. Both Pettis and Every comment often on currencies and global trade and capital flows. And so I thought we could talk about that today with a focus on examining the idea, which a lot of people have, which is the solution to many of our monetary problems is to go back to the gold standard. In other words, where gold is basically the form of money. And if there is a currency, it's backed by gold, meaning that you only issue as much currency as you have gold in reserve. And so I thought we could kind of look at that or critique that idea.
Yeah, and that sounds great. And it's very interesting. And it goes back in history. If you want to bring us back into how it was being done, like during the gold standard years and leading up into 1971 with President Nixon, Richard Milhouse Nixon, and what happened during that time.
Yeah, well, thank you, Richard. And so we all know that the gold standard, or if you want to call it precious metals, because of course silver was also money in the ancient world. So gold and silver were the money in the ancient world, starting in the Bronze Age, 1500 BC through the whole Roman era, the Byzantine Empire, so on. And so we can examine history and look at the strengths and weaknesses of using like a gold standard. And so the thing about gold or silver as the only recognized form of money is that it's like, how do you deal with credit? Because commerce, of course, is ideally, just paid in cash on the barrelhead, but actual like global trade and manufacturing and many other aspects of commerce actually require credit to work. In other words, the voyage to go on a trading mission is funded by investors usually, and then they sort of have to wait for the return. In other words, they don't get to cash out of their investment until the ship returns with its goods, and those are sold at a profit. So the ancient world and even the medieval world operated with credit that was like bills of sale, what we would call purchase orders essentially nowadays. And so, and that's how the large trading fairs that were the primary form of commerce in medieval Europe, that's how they operated too. People would bring all their goods and trade with with basically paper notations, bills of sales and so on. And then those would be settled in gold or silver. So what that means is you can do a lot more business if there's some credit, some commercial credit, right? Because gold and silver in most of history have been scarce. And so therefore, if you have to pay in cash, then your the flow of commerce is limited. So the issue here that I want to stress is you have to integrate credit somehow into your system. And as author David Graeber, who wrote this book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, and his point was that credit has always been a key form of money and a key element in any economic order. So there's that issue. So then advancing up to the 1960s, what happened was the United States was the dominant trading partner, after World War II, because its industrial base hadn't been destroyed like the industrial base in Japan and Germany and the rest of Europe. So the US started running trade deficits, meaning that that the US encouraged weak currencies in our trading partners, our allies, so that they could export their surplus production to the United States, right? And that was a had a geopolitical purpose. In the Cold War, then the US was attempting to support its allies against the danger of them falling into the sphere of communism, right? And obviously, if your allies are impoverished, then communism's going to potentially look quite appealing. So the US had geopolitical purposes for running trade deficits. And in it, but the problem with a gold standard is if you're running trade deficits, then eventually all your gold is transferred overseas because that's how you settle trade deficits is with gold. And so Nixon really had no choice but to close the gold window because the deficits were getting large enough that all of America's gold would have been transferred over as part of the deficit trade. So that's when people say, well, all of our problems started when Nixon closed the gold window. Well, he did it. He really didn't have a choice. And my point here that I want to emphasize is trade is never quite free. We like to call it free trade, but there's always other elements and factors involved, geopolitics, mercantilism, where the domestic policy of the government can be emphasizing exports as the engine of the of that economy's growth through all kinds of policy mechanisms. And then on the importing side, like the US runs deficits because it imports much cheaper goods and services. And so then that's considered a benefit. And US corporations have offshored production and in order to increase their profits, which if you look at a chart of America's corporate profits over the last, say, 40 years, you'll see an enormous spike from basically the entry of China into the WTO around 2001. And so corporate profits have soared, like tripled into into the 3-4 trillion range from like less than a trillion a year. So there's benefits to that, but it's set by domestic policy. So that's one of the things we have to consider is it's not just free trade. There's always other issues.
Yeah, there's lots of other issues. And if you can elaborate also, like what are the challenges of the economy that we've had in recent years, especially between exporting countries, mercantilist countries, and currents and countries basically implementing the reserve status.
Yeah, those are great issues. And I think what I want to bring up is something that's called Triffin's paradox after the American economist Triffin. And the idea here is that if a country is going to issue a reserve currency, Now, this is a fiat currency, right? It's not gold backed, right? It's their currency that they issue that's based on their economy or bonds. And so if you're going to issue a reserve currency, you have to issue it in sufficient quantity that other nations can use that currency for commerce and credit, and also for reserves. And so the mechanism that's generally recognized to do this is to run trade deficits, because what you're doing is you're exporting your currency and you're importing goods and services from other nations, who then end up with your currency in and then they use that for reserves. And there's only so many things they can do with that other than hold it in reserve. They can buy something from you, or they can buy assets in your country, or a bond denominated in your currency, and so on. And so the US is, for example, it has a reserve currency, the dollar. And so there's trillions of dollars out there. And so there's the dollar is can be viewed as like sort of the grease for global commerce. And of course, this gives the US certain amounts of power or leverage that is now recognized as a negative. And in the case of Michael Pettis, as he's made the point that it's actually a negative for the US as well to be running such large deficits. And so he recommends or sees as a better solution, like the erosion to sort of getting out of running huge deficits and supporting a reserve currency. And so in other words, there's not all it's not all beneficial to have a reserve currency, because you're exposing your economy to certain risks by running these huge deficits. And one of the concerns is obviously nowadays is everyone's looking at trade not just as profit or profitable, but as national security. In other words, you want to secure your supply chains. And so this raises the other issue, which is, how do we value currencies? And so if we use, let's say the world reverted to a gold and silver standard where only gold and silver were money, well, the price of gold and silver would be set globally. And so it wouldn't really be up to some policymaker in an individual nation to decide what to peg their currency to. All the international trade would be settled in gold and silver, and that the price of those forms of money would be set internationally, in the global marketplace. And so compare that to what we have now, which is domestic policymakers in China, the EU, Japan, the US. They have all these levers to influence the international or global value of their currency, right? They can raise or lower interest rates. They can buy other currencies. They can sell other currencies. And they can restrict capital flows. There's all sorts of mechanisms that domestic nations can use to influence or set the value of their currency. And as you and I were discussing before we started recording, there's a lot of jockeying, especially in mercantilist economies, which depend on exports for a large part of their economic growth, like China, the EU, Japan, South Korea, and so on, is they don't want their currencies to become so strong that their exports are hampered. They don't want to lose competitive position, but they also don't want to weaken
Right.
it so much. And so you lose all that control in a gold standard, because you really can't change the value of gold on the international marketplace. And so that's why nations are wary of going to a gold standard, is because they would lose a lot of control and power. And so you could say, well, that's a good thing, but that depends on your point of view. If you're a policymaker, you may want to retain into the control or influence over the value of your currency. So that's another big issue in terms of like reverting to a gold-backed international trade system.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
And how do you see the last couple of decades between what's been happening in especially Asian countries, and they're trying to devalue their currency for getting an export, you know, competitive export advantage with a lower value currency to be able to help facilitate more exports to the especially to the US.
Right. It's an interesting and very complex subject, and I don't claim any expertise. I'm simply an interested observer, but we've seen arguments online for China to devalue its currency. We've also seen counter arguments that no, China will increase the value of its currency vis-a-vis the dollar. We've seen a lot of theories that China is acquiring large amounts of gold so that it can issue a gold-backed currency. So there's a lot of cross currents, and that's what makes it so fascinating, because currencies are a number of things. In other words, they are, of course, a form of money, but they're also a reflection of the economic vitality of the issuing nation or trading bloc. And they're also a reflection of capital flows. And so it's like you can peg a currency to gold or some other currency, and you can use various levers to try to keep its value within a range that you deem appropriate. But if you don't let money in and out of your country, then you're restricting the capital flows in and out of your currency. And so it's like sort of like, imagine a pipe. And if you have a very small pipe, like, a half inch tube, that there's so little capital can go in and out of it, then your currency is going to always have a very small share of the global trade. Whereas if you have a giant, 8 foot diameter, pipe of currency, capital flows, like the US dollar, famously trades something like 3 trillion a day. And then if you look at like charts of how much currency is traded every day, you see that the Chinese yuan or RMB is just a little over 2% on the same scale as like the Swiss franc or the Canadian dollar. So in other words, people can they can kind of exaggerate the potential of what can happen in currencies, but you have to look at capital flows. And so if there's restrictions on capital flows, or there's just not enough liquidity in a market, then that's going to affect it. So, and since we're talking about China acquiring gold and maybe setting itself up to issue a gold-backed currency, I want to talk about that a little bit too briefly, because I think when people talk about a gold-backed currency, they don't really understand what's involved in a gold-backed currency. So, and I want to mention the role of credit again, because in the modern economy, a great deal of what we call money, like currency, is created when a loan is originated or issued. So when a mortgage for $1 million is originated at a bank, that $1 million is actually new money. That money was created. It was not drawn from the savings of depositors, like many people who are unfamiliar with the banking system. That's what they imagine. That's not the case. We have a fractional reserve banking system, and so does the rest of the world, that the banks can issue multiples of their cash in hand. So if you have a gold-backed system and a bank has $10 million of gold in its reserves, it has to hold back at, like say half in case depositors withdraw their money and so on. So you can't just loan out every ounce of gold you have, or and so you go, well, then they can only banks can only loan like 50% of the gold or gold-backed currency they have in reserve. And so compare that to that's a very limited amount of credit that's available. In other words, it's basically you get the only credit in the system is half of what's in savings, essentially. So that's a very small pool of capital, and that's similar to the ancient world where there were no 30-year mortgages. There was no fractional reserve banking system, and so credit was extremely scarce because it was like, yeah, somebody's savings, you could borrow their savings, but only that much. And so what you'd have is in the modern world, we have a system that creates 10 times more money than is held in reserve. So if you imagine that in a gold-backed system, if like say a nation had $100 billion worth of gold, say, that's all the money that you're allowed to issue. In other words, you can't be like creating $10 trillion in new money through credit. And then say that, oh yeah, our monetary base is only it's only 100 billion. It's like, no, that's not the case. And so you see the point being, if you allow credit to be issued on the scale that it's now issued and that the global economy depends on, then you're going to devalue your currency immediately, because you're creating all this new money that's not backed by some new ish discovery of gold or this new acquisition of gold. It's just created out of thin air. So you can imagine what happens to the modern economy if there's no credit, or the credit shrinks down to like a tiny percentage of what's issued now. So no auto loans, no student loans, no mortgages. Everything is only a percentage of what's in savings, and so that would radically reduce the amount of credit available, and it would obviously increase the cost of borrowing because the people with capital to loan out can then charge whatever the market will bear. So these are issues that it's like we'd like a simple solution, and I understand that like Bitcoin maximalists believe that Bitcoin is the solution. If we just adopt that, then all of our problems go away. And the same is true of people who feel that returning to the gold standard would solve all our problems. They're forgetting or sort of setting aside all these other issues of geopolitical concerns, national security concerns, the control of the value of the currency, that power that nations want to retain, and also the whole issue of how do you deal with credit. So all of
Right.
that leads to what's the solution in a from the Austrian school perspective. And so maybe you can outline what the Austrian school would see as a solution.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly on the Austrian school of economics tradition, there's an emphasis on scarcity, elements of scarcity, and there's a lot to be said for the scarcity of, gold, for example, and how it's been used in the past economic systems. But what has basically happened, like if you in it, what's happening right now is the new president of Argentina, he's an Austrian school economist. And he is basically allowing a plethora, a variety of currencies to exist in the provinces. He's essentially done an edict to allow the provinces to issue their own money, whether that mean what, different types of cash or even cryptocurrencies would be allowed, different cryptocurrencies, essentially whatever makes sense for them. And so the idea is to create a free market of currencies. And this makes sense within the Austrian School of Economics tradition, to create a free market of that and allow other currencies to coexist and to compete, and then just to allow the free market to decide which one is better. And you could have decentralized type of currencies. Some will make sense more in one environment, one jurisdiction versus another environment, another jurisdiction. So that's essentially the philosophy he has, which he is now implementing in Argentina. Your thoughts, Charles?
Yeah, that sounds very similar to what I've always proposed or said in my writings, which is the solution is to let an open market find the value of every currency that's available. And I think that that's a brilliant plan to allow regional currencies because this has been used occasionally throughout history, and a lot of people are quite interested in this idea that even in the down to the local level of townships or cities issuing script, it has worked in the past. And so I like that idea a lot, and because it removes the monopoly of a central government attempting to control the value of the currency for what often works out to be the benefit of the financial elite, not the public. And so if everyone is allowed to use whatever currency works for them, then it's much more likely that we'll have the flexibility and adaptability and problem solving that creates solutions, from the ground up. And I think so. I'm a huge fan of that concept of multiple currencies traded in a free market.
Yeah.
And just as an example, if you have multiple kinds of currency, then they can meet different needs. In other words, so for savings, maybe you would then use gold and silver, like rock solid, that's your savings, but you might borrow money in a local currency because you need it for your business day to day. And so you don't need like gold to deal with day to day business. You can use a local script or some other currency. So, and then cryptocurrencies would then play a role depending on supply and demand. Like what works for people would then be valued, and what didn't work so well would devalue. And so, I think that is an ideal solution, especially in a market with a global economy that's now entering so much, we could say rapid change, or we could say a potential disorder or competing solutions. All of those things would then play out in the market, and instead of being top down, forced by some central state. So I think that that kind of plays into my idea that most solutions work from the bottom up rather than being top down.
Yes, exactly. And so, in terms of a vision for the future for this type of best currency, I guess we can say that there is no one perfect currency or money. The best system is a market of competing currencies. And you would say that, as you recently just summarized, let people and enterprises choose whatever forms of money works best for them.
That's right. And then that will work up the chain regionally and nationally. And in other words, it'll benefit the local region, and it will eventually benefit the whatever nation allows this solution.
Well, great. Yeah, that's been a fascinating summary of the history of money and the challenges, you know, for being a currency. Thanks very much for the discussion, Charles. How can our listeners and viewers that are watching it via YouTube learn more about your work, Charles?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com or look up Charles Hugh Smith on Substack. Thank you very much, Richard.
Great. Thanks, Charles.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.